Hello, I'm Sagar Baroshi.
I'm John Ingold.
Welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Each week, we open to a new article in the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book, and we speak to the author of that article about their topic. So it's all about game narrative and the craft of game writing. And today we have Jill Murray here with us. Hello, Jill.
Hi.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? What's brought you to this community, to this profession, and where you are now?
Sure. Let's work backwards. Right now, I'm working on a couple of lovely games with amazing Canadian studios that are based out of Toronto. I myself am based in Montreal, and the games are called Reply All, which is a card battler where email is combat.
It's so true.
And the other game is called Roller Girl, which is about being a bored queer teen skating around a small town in the mid-2000s. So I'm having a lot of extremely different kinds of fun on both of those. And I've also decided to do an MFA in writing creative nonfiction, which I'm doing out of the University of King's College in Halifax, Nova Scotia. So I'm kind of spreading myself out across Canada, at least in the East. People probably know me best from my writing on AAA games in the Assassin's Creed franchise, like Liberation and Freedom Cry, or from Shadow of the Tomb Raider. But really, most of my time for the last 10 or 15 years has been spent working on indie games of various sizes. And that's where I am happiest. Not that I would say no to a nice, juicy, gigantic contract of the types you can get from AAA or like a Subnautica or even I did Invincible Presents Adam E. If that was a nice like contract of a couple of years too. So yeah, that's me.
Amazing. So you've done the sort of spread of AAA to indie. It's lovely that some of the people we talk to have been very embedded in AAA studios for a long time, and some of them are just super, super indie, which I guess is kind of the category I put myself in. But like, mm-hmm. we also meet people who've seen both sides of this.
Yeah, I've got like foot on the shore and one foot in like a rowboat.
And sometimes the boat comes towards the shore and sometimes it's going
sometimes
away.
You do the splits and that's and we make a life that way.
Yeah, that's the true description of the freelancer life. So we always start the podcast by asking you if you could just sort of introduce your article that was in the book and what was just sort of outline for people who may or may not have read it. Sort of what were you talking about? What did you have to say?
Absolutely. So my essay is about a couple of topics that are kind of like old favorite standards of mine, and I've brought them together into something that is about how to use actually finishing your projects as a way of getting past imposter syndrome. Because I believe that when a project's scope balloons, it actually drives uncertainty and imposter syndrome and insecurity, which makes things take longer. It becomes like a self-perpetuating cycle. So if you can train yourself as a creative to focus on finishing, closing, shipping, then you can do less imposting. Not that there's anything wrong with being an imposter. I think you should just like get in there and impost and like sneak around and see how long you can get away with it. So that's the gist of what my article is about. Hopefully it's just something that people read and go, oh, okay, I'm going to be okay. But also, damn, I don't want to finish anything. That's a pain.
Yeah. I mean, when I read it, it really spoke to me because I have an elder brother who's an extremely creative person, but he's not a creative professional. And I remember when he was a kid, he would always be doing a million projects. He was so like always new ideas. But I kind of noticed about age 12 or 13 that he never finished anything. And so it was a bit like what you said in your article, actually. I thought, hang on, if I can just finish anything, I'm going to beat my elder brother at this game. And that's pretty, I said before the call started, I'm a writer who's driven by spite. And one of my standard questions now for people is going to be, are you a writer driven by spite or love? Because that seems to be the two camps. I do want to know. But yeah, that's where I discovered the true power of just trying to beat the other guy in the room. But there you go. That's my
I
story.
mean, like, if you think of anything, any media product you've ever loved, like, they all have something in common with each other, and that's that they're finished.
So that's the
So,
one thing you have to make sure that you definitely aim for,
it's in your
or else no
control.
one sees
You can
it.
do it. So, you might as well do that one first, since it's not it dependent on investors or luck or finding an audience or getting the energy to be a content creator to promote your own work or all of these other things that are asked of us as creative people. Like, it's you can just finish. And I think that's just maybe very basic, but also kind of amazing when you think about how seldom things get finished and how within reach that is as a creative tool.
So I think a really cool question for me is, how do you know when something is near the end? Like, do you, I mean, no one is suggesting you just do the bare minimum, right? That you sort of like, you want a scene with a dog? Fine, there's a dog. Woof. Okay, I'm done. I'm going. So how do you know when you've reached the end of a project? How do you know when it's closing down? How do you know when that extra idea that you've had just
I
doesn't
think
need
it's
to be
like,
there?
so one option is never, but the definition we can go with is it's a combination of when you are completely sick of it and other people seem to be enjoying it. Or alternatively, since other people are starting to enjoy it, you've managed to sell it to someone or commit to a Kickstarter. There is a deadline that's been imposed. That helps. So, for example, I had a Bitsy game that was unfinished for a long time. I'd put a ton of time into all this pixel art. If anybody doesn't know Bitsy, it's awesome. It's, oh yeah, maybe we can put a URL in show notes or something. But it's just a teeny tiny game engine that runs in the browser. You can make pixel art, walk around and poke at things, and do very extremely limited amount of code and like two colors per room, and you can make anything that you imagine that way. And so I was working on this game about this legendary like maple syrup heist and maple syrup cartel in Quebec, and I
Tell
was
us
like, it's
more.
gonna
This
be
sounds
like the
great.
Québécois Fargo. It's I could see it. I could sense it. I had like all this art made of like snow, a cabin in the snow, and like these like barrels hidden under a basement, and like really pushing my own limits of like what I could represent in two color bulky pixel art. And I was so attached to the idea, it was like I couldn't finish it. And it wasn't until very recently the Game Poems magazine came into existence, and they had a theme that I've already forgotten what the theme was. I think it was like first steps or something of that nature. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to take all that old Bitsy stuff and I'm going to use it to make something else. And I just made a sweet little Bitsy game about finishing things. So still very on theme, but also, about all of the things that prevent us from finishing, all of the feelings that we have stored in those barrels in the basement, the wilderness that we find ourselves wandering through when we're trying to make creative work. Yeah, and I pulled it all together. I sent it off. They did not accept it, but
Ladies and gentlemen, we are
Jordan
in the hands of a
Peters, please.
storyteller
Yes, exactly. What an ending.
No,
I was not
but get
expecting
this.
that.
Get this.
Okay, sorry, yes.
Jordan, who created started all of this, he took it with him to poetry festivals in the UK. And so
Amazing.
my little Bitsy game is now on my resume as having poetry festivals in the UK, which if you're in Canada, always sounds like, oh, she must really know what she's doing. In the
It's serious,
UK.
no.
So I'm like very happy with that outcome. And it was a good reminder to myself of like, hey, client work takes a lot of energy and is very demanding. I finish a lot of projects through client work, but to also finish some of my own projects sometimes and to take them seriously enough to get done, but not so seriously that they're just in a holding pattern for a whole time.
Yeah, I think that's really strong. We've definitely heard from other people that we've spoken to this idea of trying to maintain your personal side as you're working, and like it can be very, you sometimes have to really fight for it.
Yeah,
Yeah.
totally.
But the maple syrup heist plot, that's still an open goal, right? That hasn't been
Oh,
done. That's
man.
still there. That's still on the
I
table.
know they somebody so in the intervening years, somebody made like a I think it was a Netflix series called The Sticky.
Really?
Yeah.
Right. On
That's
that
how
subject,
long
made it to
I sat on this
the
idea long enough for
UK.
someone to read probably the original Vanity Fair article, which is amazing. Think this would make a good story. Develop a whole pilot, pitch it, sell it, cast it, write it, record it, release it, and then for other people apparently to have not noticed or forgotten. And then I was like, oh, I should do something with that.
Well, things come around and around and around, don't they, right? I wonder a little bit, because this is such a familiar feeling, the sense that like maybe I'm not worth it, or like this whole structure seems like so much. And after all, your article says a lot about player expectations as well, and like what the sort of tension of that
Oh,
and how you
yeah.
feel. Since you've had a career that's varied across media and even across sections of the games industry, have you felt that that pressure is different, or the challenge of finishing, or of even having, say, agency over being able to finish changes depending on, say, whether you're in your consultancy working on client work
Oh,
or
yeah. I mean, it
inside?
changes wildly. I think anybody who has worked as a contractor knows that every once in a while you hit on a client that can't finish things, and then you're trying to kind of like backseat drive the client towards finding whatever is missing from their soul so that they can find a way to finish. And that doesn't always work. Like I've had clients that never gave any feedback and then just changed the idea completely. Or I've had clients that were like so focused on the very original starting idea that they didn't have any room to let the game kind of show them what it wanted to be and just run with it, which I think is another thing that makes a project finishable, is that if you're not like gripping onto your original idea and using it to screen out possibilities, like, oh no, I can't do that because it would be a betrayal of the historical material. I can't do this because everybody knows that like this genre of game requires certain things. I can't do that because I don't know, my friend or my design teacher wouldn't like it. Like if you, I think relax, not relax, if you pay attention, at some point I think the thing you're trying to make will give you clues about how it can be completable. And that often involves letting go of things and jettisoning them and telling yourself, well, I could hit that objective next time. This project is gonna be like plenty complete and satisfying if I don't fulfill these stretch goals and if I just find a way to get it done and accept that it's going to be different from what I originally planned, but that also better from what I originally planned because of all the things I learned while I was trying to make it.
I really like that. Like, you hear the advice of kill your darlings a lot, right? When you're writing, especially if you're kind of in control of the project, you're writing a novel.
Yeah.
Oh, you've got to kill your darlings. You've got to be brave enough to cut out those bits that you
Right.
really fought for. But like, that's such a creatively bankrupt way of phrasing it, because like, no, you shouldn't kill your darlings. You should cut the bits that don't work.
Yes, cut this don't work. I
Like,
mean,
you
I
might
think
like them or not like them, but
I feel like the original intention of the phrase was like, don't get so attached to
attached.
things that you can't see the project for what it is. Like
Yeah,
there's a
it's one thing
certain
for like
just go around.
Yeah, a common writerly problem, which is that we get too attached. We love our characters or our scenes or whatever.
An artist I know recently told me that in their art school, they were told to go looking for things they loved and then kill it because they loved it. And I was like, okay, absolutely not. The fact that you love something is not an indication that you should get rid of it. Like, you're the first person that has to love your work. If you're not loving your work, then you need to figure out, is there a different way I could be making this? Do I need to make something else first? Is there a particular audience that would be good for this? And I just need to focus on them and cut everybody out of my, you can't be worried about angry people on the internet the entire time you're making a thing. You have to at some point decide to make your work for people who are going to actually like it.
So when you're kind of in the weeds of a project and looking to find that kind of route to the finish, so you're lost in a forest and there's lots of paths and one of them will get you out and you need to feel your way, how do you go about feeling your way? How do you get that distance? How can you judge the material? What sort of strategies do you use? But also, how does it feel when you're doing it? What's that like? Can you describe it?
Yeah, I think it can change. There are some projects, especially Assassin's Creed Liberation, let's stick with that one. Especially Assassin's Creed Liberation is okay, I've got the sound of this character's voice in my head. I have people in mind that I'm making it for. I want them to see their history represented and represented well, and I want them to be proud and I want to give them hope. And so I'm just thinking that the whole time. And so every decision is coming through that lens of, is this going to provide those people with a sense of pride and belonging and recognition? That in a way is easy. It gives me a very heavy feeling of responsibility that can make me frustrating to work with for other people sometimes, because it's hard to give other people access to that sense of urgency. In my own work, often it's just letting myself off the hook and being like, it's okay to take the easy way out. There's not actually an easy way out. That's just a construction. That's just a corner that I've boxed myself into. Or sometimes I always think of the image of a comedian on stage dying. If you read your own work, I like to read everything, every single thing out loud and just hear how it sounds when I'm saying it. And if I'm there in my office, by myself, cringing, no one else can even hear me, then I'm like, ooh, okay, I'm glad this isn't a live stand-up comedy act that I'm workshopping and I can actually just cut out the parts that feel like dying before anyone else sees it. That can be good. And then the biggest thing that I always come back to though is really, especially for not for personal writing that's me expressing myself from the heart, but for client work that's supposed to hit an audience or my own work that I'm like, okay, it needs to reach people. Define who your player is and who your ideal player is, and then make all of the decisions for that person. Because you cannot please anybody. Work that tries to please everybody doesn't usually please very many people at all. You can feel it stretched thin or insincere. But work that is made for a particular kind of player will usually attract, I believe, other people around it, because the vision becomes that much more clear. You know what it is that you're being asked to buy into. And also that you know that there is that base person that it's for, that it's going to find an audience because it's for that
person,
little girl sitting over there, or that guy that you knew, you can figure out exactly. Yeah.
I love the clarity of that. It reminds me when I'm I do a few talks. I quite enjoy doing talks. It's because I always wanted to be a stand-up comedian, but exactly that problem that you said of dying is too scary. So like I write because I can fix it before anyone sees it, and I like doing talks because then I know why I'm there and it doesn't matter if they don't laugh. But you always, the way to get through a talk, it's nerve-wracking, speaking to 100 people or whatever, is you find one person in the audience who looks engaged, who's sort of nodding at roughly the right places and smiling, and you just completely focus and just end up giving a talk to this one person in the room. And if the other people hear it and like it, that's fine, but then you don't really care about them. You only care about this one person. And it's, it's surprisingly effective, but like, it's interesting to do that for a piece of writing, especially when you're working on a project that's going to so many people. Like one of the things I find slightly overwhelming about the work that we do in games is that when a game is a hit, it's there's a lot of people who see your work. Do you really manage to shed the weight of that when you're working on like a bigger project, or
the everyone being out there is so nebulous, it's hard to even put a face to it, right? Also, like coming from my kind of like nerdy theater reading background, as a teenager, I fell in love with the writing of Kurt Vonnegut, and he has his theory of like the audience of one. So he's not just thinking of one type of person. He's thinking of exactly one person. In one of his books, he had a character who was a YA writer, and she was writing her books, I think, for her, I want to say, brain surgeon husband, and that was it. So I always think of that too, because if somebody's smarter, that much smarter than you, and more, and so with so much humanity and warmth and humanism about them, can work that way, then like, okay, that's something I can attach myself to. So I guess the answer is that I write out of love, then. if I'm just trying to take care of the reader or the player, then it is.
The individual out of love. I mean, it almost seemed like when you were describing a little earlier in the conversation, you were describing liberation, and you almost made it sound like there were sort of specific people that you would think about, not just sort of an archetype of a person. Do you ever? Is that something that you do? Do you sort of think like, oh, even if they don't actually play it, this is the sort of person in my life that I know that I think would enjoy this title? Is that a helpful technique to use?
In that case, it was so close. So the character in Liberation, her father was like a bourgeois French merchant, and her mother was a former slave from Saint-Domingue, which is now Haiti. And at the time, my partner at the time, his niece had been recently born, and her mom was French-Canadian and her dad was Haitian. So I just wrote that entire game to this baby.
That's
extraordinary.
Listeners, you can't see our faces, but me and Saga both just went, That's genuinely beautiful. I love that. Do you feel that the writing in that game kind of came out well? Are you happy with it? Did that approach sort of work on the reflection of a few years have gone by, and you can look at it kind of critically? I mean that's the right answer, but I just want to check.
That was a wild ride. I was like 3 months or so into the industry, and they're just like, you know, once you're hired into Ubisoft at the time, you would just stay there, and they'd be like, all right, you're done working on the fitness game, here's this Assassin's Creed game on the Vita, and you're like, okay, and they're like, can you go to Bulgaria on Tuesday? What is happening? And we figured it out. We were a small team in Montreal supporting the Bulgarian studio, and everybody cared so much, but because it was a handheld game, it like didn't have the resources of the other games over there, and you just figure out how to make do with, well, not, I don't want to say make do even, because it's still a lot of resources compared to most games, but you know, the cinematics I don't think there's one cinematic in the game that's like longer than 30 seconds. I was editing out syllables of words to get it all to fit. It
I know that
becomes
feeling.
Like poetry. Yeah. There's one point in the game where like a placeholder animation is used seriously. I don't know if that probably didn't make it into the remaster, but it was one of my favorite things in the original game. A character is like, you know, you're setting up the quest and it's like, okay, I'm going to run over there and distract them. And then you go around that way and, you know, do whatever violence you're going to do. And the distraction that they came up with was there was this like temp animation of doing like the funky chicken dance. And so, like runs over there, does the funky chicken. Like, yep, that's distracting. And
okay, I've got serious concerns as to whether that's historically accurate or not. Did the funky chicken exist?
La danse, it's la danse des canards, usually in French. I don't know. I don't know if that was pre-colonial.
Listeners, we will have to check and research how old la danse des canards is. Right?
Lost track of what I was saying, or what the question was.
Let me ask something else then. So I was struck by when you were talking about the games that you're working on now. So you're obviously working on a game about, I think it was a roller skating teenager. Is that right? I think that's right.
Yeah.
And you specifically said it was in the 2000s. And
yeah.
You wrote The Big Con as well.
That's
I'm
going to
edit this out. If I've got this wrong, I'll edit it. The Big Con. And obviously that's the 90s as well. And Assassin's Creed is obviously very historical stuff as well.
The email game is also set in the 90s.
Right.
Oh, is it? Right. Okay.
The late 90s. So,
like when email is new and people are using it. Yeah.
I get the sense that you're drawn to historical settings over fantastical ones. Is that fair?
No. My career was so random. Like the novels that I wrote before I worked in games, when I was still working as a web developer, my novels were about breakdancing teenagers. Because breakdancing was a thing I was doing at the time that my first unpublishing novel died its last gasping breaths. And my agent at the time was like, maybe you could write a different novel. Stop rewriting this novel. So I was like, what do I care about? I care about breakdancing. Like that's what I do with all of my free time. Okay. So so my books were dancing, and the way I kind of like conned my way into the industry was I was able to say that like my dance writing is not that different from writing to tell people how to do exercises on this fitness game.
Because that was the first project,
and then
right?
Literally, when I was done that, they're like, please go work on this thing. And so
which is
it's
Assassin's
more
Creed
about
in the 1700s.
Like landing places and then figuring out what's needed and then doing that.
Mm.
So in theory, I could figure out sci-fi if I had to. It's just...
Mm-hmm.
Once you start doing things, people keep offering you more of the things that you've been doing, and then it starts to look like your brand.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. But it may not be, right? Yeah. I love that you brought this up, because in the prep for this interview, I saw these breakdancing novels and I was like, what? This is incredible. And I didn't entirely realize that you yourself, of course it makes sense that you yourself were really active in the scene, that you were doing these things, but...
I was like not a good dancer, to be clear. I was like an enthusiast and an admirer of the culture and the history and of dance in general.
But we all have to impost somewhere, I suppose, right? And like that's
exactly.
That's
so
where it comes from.
Really imposted big time.
I asked because like I danced my whole childhood. That was like my only real sort of creative outlet for a lot of my youth. And when I sort of started looking into coming to the creative industry, I was sort of slightly scared of this background. I didn't really want to talk about it to all of these like producers who were interviewing me and things, right? But like now that I feel way more secure, I'm not, you know, you don't have those things after a certain while. I find the sort of dance background incredibly valuable, actually. Like the need to sort of like be able to improvise, to move quickly, to be able to understand things at a broader scale in formations,
absorb feedback and then give
yeah,
it back.
Yeah, to physicalize even sometimes things. Like, this yeah. is like stage training too. And because you cross these worlds so well, like you have theater background, you have dance background. I'm curious if you have felt similarly or maybe not at all. Maybe it's too far away.
So my theater background, just to be clear, is in theater production. So okay. I wanted okay. to design scenery and make costumes and do all that kind of stuff. And we had marketing classes and stuff. This is something I've talked about with people on social media a lot, and there seems to be a general consensus that a theater background is very transferable to games. Yeah. Mm. I think like Hannah Nicklin came out of theater too.
Yeah, there's a quite yeah. a few of the, we've observed this before, quite a few of the authors in the collection that we've spoken to so far have theatre backgrounds. There's a surprisingly large number of people with opera backgrounds, which I thought was really specific and quite surprising. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I like that because you go from one culture which spends far too much to produce a single work that's for quite a niche audience, and then you go into games and you go, oh, look, we're doing the same thing again, and up go the ticket prices.
Well, but, I think what they really have in common is that the audience is participatory in a way mm-hmm. that they are less so. Like, I think, like, film, for example, translates less well to video games because yeah. for the audience, it is more passive, whereas theater with a live audience, even in conventional theater, the audience is working hard. But then especially when you get into theater in the round, where you don't know what perspective the audience is going to have, and then to like situational theater, like Sleep No More, where, you know, people might be following the actors around, or to like, I don't know, in Toronto, there was it's probably still running. There was something called Dusk Dances, where a bunch of different dance companies do performances in a park, and the audience needs to go from place to place to see each performance. So I think like being adaptable to the environment and to the different perspectives that your audience is going to have, and then also thinking of all those little things that you, safety things that you have to when you have an ambulatory audience, or even if they're in the theater, because like the history of the way theaters as buildings is designed is it comes down to like when were there fires and what happened in those fires. So I think that kind of like more participatory relationship of the creator to the audience is to a large degree responsible to being able to translate that training to games training.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. Something I've thought about, because I've had exactly the same conversation with people before, that like theater is this really important resource that we should be using as game writers and game designers to think about how we tell stories. And I think for me, it often comes down to the amount of suspension of disbelief work that you're asking the audience to do, because a player has to believe that this world is a world, and we all know it isn't, and it visibly isn't. Like, the characters are all robots, the walls are solid, the corridors are all the perfect width, you know, whatever it might be. And you go to a theatre audience and they're pretending that the wobbly cloth is the sea and the box is.
Yeah. And I think this is especially useful for indie games with lower budgets, because in theatre, like, your entire game you might have to build Rome for $50 Canadian. It's like $3 of your money. and to have that confidence of like, you know what, we don't have to have it be like with like high graphic fidelity. Like, what, think about what it is you're trying to represent and what are the essential parts of that are going to feel like the concept of Rome to your audience or your player. And just find a way to get it done. And maybe it's blocky pixels in Big C, and you can still tell a story that moves people, that gets into British museums.
I love that you said this, actually, Jill, because literally yesterday I had a thought really similar. I was talking about this with my wife. It's because we just watched, kind of randomly, we watched this movie, The City of Lost Children, this sort of like classic from a little while ago. And then, in comparison, we have just started Pluribus, the sort of big new television show. And it just sort of occurred to me that I'm like, there is something quite extraordinary about linear media, I suppose, because we're so used to it nowadays being of such a high fidelity and to have like such high budgets that they almost all, it feels natural to watch something like Pluribus, where they're just sort of like pulling out budget after budget out of nowhere to produce these extraordinary moments. But in fact, there's something really quite special when you can see the set dressing, right? When it feels like it's almost all on a stage, like the City of Lost Children kind of feels like. It feels like you're being taken through a quite extraordinary theater performance. It almost felt like maybe me as the audience member, I just sort of sat back and I was like, oh yes, this is just meant to evoke this feeling, or it's meant to like produce this thing. And if I play a game where actually you almost show the workings a little bit more, weirdly, sometimes it has for me that double effect of saying, oh yeah, actually that's fine. I don't need to like test it against total realism, photorealism, what have you.
Yeah.
Have you seen that change as you've moved from, certainly as you move from like the sort of mainstream AAA games to slightly smaller budget titles? Is that a technique you've had to use?
I think that plays back into that like letting go of things thing that I was saying earlier about just accepting what you have to work with as a path to finishing. What I was thinking about while you were speaking was that there is something comforting about being like, oh, this was made with human hands and I am being drawn into it. And I do wonder if that is going to gain maybe some like a resurgence or a popularity as we struggle with like AI slop being injected into things and like being questioned for how many hyphens you write with, or m-dashes rather. I wonder if there's something like grounding and or cozy or like any number of other adjectives about that we could benefit from right now. I'd be like, okay, I'm going to show you a little, I'm going to let you, I won't show you all the tricks of how I made this, but I'm going to include things in it that let you know that I did make it and how it felt to make it. Try to let you inside a little bit. It's a form of vulnerability, right? Vulnerability is mostly what we're attracted to in media, whether or not.
It's very true.
Amazing. I think I always struggle a little bit with that because on the one hand, I really like it when we make things that are lumpy and a little bit awkward and sort of I hate the word janky, it's so pejorative, but just sort of rough edged. Like I like it when just stupid stuff. I like it when the dialogue isn't always quite the right length, or when things just don't quite fit together and you get this sense that this machine is clunking over and it's working. I like that because it feels handmade. It feels kind of like it's pushing the limits of what it can be in an interesting way. But on the flip side, I often find that players are kind of a little bit obsessed about how things actually work. Like we write a lot of branching narrative and they're constantly trying to unwire the branching narrative and sort of go, oh, you see, this causes this and this branch does that and this one does the other. And I kind of try to say to them as politely as you can, look, I spent a long time wiring this narrative. Could you please not just take it apart in public? Because that's like the single thing I don't want you to do. But, and I do wonder whether there's a sort of tension between the way we want the audience to kind of come in and do the imaginative work to kind of get over the lumpy edges of whatever we're building and the kind of the gaps and things like that. And the fact that we just have a really technologically minded audience that is constantly trying to understand how things work. And I guess game playing is part of that as well.
The players that do that are like highly, highly literate and educated in the forum, right? Like those are the keeners that are in front of the class with their hand up. And they want to show off how much they figured out. So I think like, if you think about like audience segmentation, it's not everybody. And maybe it's okay if you have a certain number of people that are just going to like take your clock apart and spread it out on the dining room table and then show you how they can put it back together again later. Like it's kind of genius. If that's what people find fun, then great. Like my response,
form of participation.
My response to be able to see exactly how something works is to immediately stop engaging with it. So, I don't know. Yeah. I think, we like those people that are going to be like, I know how this works. Let me show you. Let me show you. Following you around for your next three games. I think it's okay.
I think it's coming back to this writing from a place of love thing that I still don't understand properly. It's like my instincts always were, if you unwired my clock, I'm going to make a tougher clock.
And you should, when they want you to. It's your, you're just in a, since you're writing out of spite, you're in like a little arms race with your audience.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it is a type of audience participation, right? Like coming back to the metaphor from theater. I mean, in fact, it's a very beautiful form of it, right? Like I was reading, I remember reading this book that was sort of saying if Shakespeare had realized the extent to which he would be being analyzed for, I don't know, his feelings about sort of politics or things or something, he would find this hilarious because he probably would have thought of himself as a craftsman that puts words together to sort of produce these things together. And in the consequence of that, he has things to say about all of this stuff. But first and foremost, he's sort of a writer, right? Like, and perhaps that's true for so many of us too, that we are trying to, we're trying to produce these little machines, these little clockwork mechanisms, especially so if they're branching narrative. And the point is for you to sort of be able to enjoy that experience in whatever way is right for you, right? Whatever way it makes sense. And I guess that maybe
you just
maybe
have to find a way to keep your other players safe from the clock disassembly players who are going to reveal all of the spoilers and all of the magic. Not everybody wants to know. But I don't know. I don't know how much those audiences mix. Like, first of all, question. They have to be people that are going to come on the forum and tell you.
Yeah, well, that's true. There's the invisible mass out there that play things and just tell their friends about it. Yeah,
people who can just true. As we say now, be normal about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is difficult for us as creatives in the current modern world, though, that the people who are being normal about it are the ones that we never see. So, like, if we're trying to build in any, if we're trying to understand our audiences, I think especially as indies, like, it can be very difficult because you never get to see your audiences.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I don't know how that, does that make it harder for you to, do you think, to write for your one person, the fact that they're sort of more obscure, or does it, do you just...
No, because I'm basically inventing the audience as much as I'm inventing the story.
Right. You're writing for the audience you want, and then they should come and find it.
Yeah. Like, hopefully the fact that I did that, and hopefully I'm running it by whoever's working on marketing so that they agree with me and they're not doing everything completely opposite to what I want. Hopefully we're on the same page. But there's only so much you can do. Like,
yeah,
you can't take responsibility for everything. Well, maybe you can, John.
No.
It's your whole outfit, but I can't take responsibility for everything. I got clients.
I just make it up and move on. It's fine. But so I have one question, which is about this idea of, so if you're writing for an audience, even if it's an audience that you've invented, and kind of thinking about what they're going to like and what they want and what's going to make them happy and what are they going to connect with and what are they going to feel represented by, is there a conflict? Is there something about, what about the truth of the work, which I can't define properly? But I have this sense when I'm writing, sometimes I'm thinking about the audience, but a lot of the time I'm thinking about what does this work need to be the right version of itself? Like, it's a kind of, I'm dissatisfied if it isn't the right version of itself. And it's something about the internal way that it talks to itself. Does that sometimes fight with the play that you're going, or is that just not a thing that you recognize in the way that you approach writing?
No, because I'm like using my idea of who this is for to resolve those internal conflicts.
Right. So the truth of it is in how it lands for the person that you're writing it to. I'm
trying to think of an example. Like, let's go back to history games and say you want to make a history game and it has to be absolutely accurate. Like, there's different ways to be absolutely accurate. You don't have to share everything in dialogue. You can put some of it in the lore, you can leave some of it out, you can decide to focus on only one part of the story. But people will sometimes come to historical material feeling like, no, it's only correct to include absolutely everything. And then it's like, oh, but then that creates issues for how the art is made and how this is made and how that. And that. It's like, well, who is this for? What do they need? Like, maybe we adapt the language so that it recalls the historical period, but it's still understandable. Maybe we merge a couple of events together so that we can keep the pace moving along. Maybe like as in theater, how much Shakespeare have you seen where it's like some scaffolding and people are wearing modern clothes? Like what are the most minimalist methods you could use to still get the fundamental point across, which I guess is like the truth that you're talking about? Like, how can it feel meaningful and sincere and like it's communicating its values? But yeah, I'm not. It probably makes me annoying sometimes that I am not too concerned. It's like, that's fine. We'll let that go. We'll focus on this. It will be okay. And it's like, well, why? How can you be so sure of that? I don't know. It's like the one part of my psychological makeup that's easy to live with. Everything else is hard. I have very clear creative vision and it doesn't bother me.
I feel like the answer to the question then of like the fundamental question that your kind of your article revolves around, and some of this conversation revolved around, you know, how do you know where you're going before you've already got there? And
you don't.
It sounds to me like your answer is you absolutely do know and you're just going in the right way. Like,
the unfollowable advice about learning to sculpt and just be like, just take away everything that isn't the thing you're trying to end
you're
up with.
Supposed to be there, yeah.
No, like, you have to be very comfortable with like making mistakes, trying things out, be able to see, oh no, that wasn't it. Change and keep going and not be self-conscious about everything not coming out of you perfectly. This can be extremely difficult in AAA environments. You know, games have a reputation for being all about collaboration, but many of our work environments are actually about competition and not collaboration. And in those circumstances, it's very hard to put yourself on the line and be like, I'm just gonna throw this out and people can like it or dislike it, we'll talk about it. And like, yeah, or maybe they'll shout at you and mock you and you'll wish you hadn't gone to work that day.
Hopefully not
run into too many more of those situations.
In fact, like, one of the hardest things is it's not necessarily malicious. It's simply that, like, in very many reasonably sized studios, it is sort of, maybe this just hasn't established itself about how writing is to work in a game environment, but it's sort of assumed that once you write words on a page, you've done your draft, and inevitably it won't be. It would be your first pass. Like, you would never ask an artist to be like, yeah, submit your concept art for the final game and you're done, right? Like, it's sort of assumed that there will be.
How much writing is just planning? And it isn't going to generate a script at all. You're just going to redraft outlines and think about structure and talk about, like, well, how does the mechanics reflect this kind of, like, personality of this character and of the world?
Yes.
And, like, drilling down to see, like, what is like the architecture of the story before you can do what everybody thinks about writing. So it's almost like 90% of the job is undervalued because nobody is aware that it's supposed to exist, or it looks too much like other things. Like, it looks too much like something a game director would be concerned about, or a creative director would be concerned about, or a game designer would be concerned about. And then sometimes those people can start to get nervous, like, why is this writer asking me all these questions about all these things? It's none of their business. They're just supposed to do the writing.
Just write it.
And you can't until you like have a working model of the game in your head. At least I can't.
You might. You need to make certain mistakes in order. Yeah. Like, you can't just arrive with the sort of final version of how this ensemble cast is to work together. Like, you have to bounce off of every door, right? And it is very, I think it's very common for the sort of production structure to punish you for that unwittingly. They don't intentionally. They're just sort of like, well, this sprint you were supposed to submit your a draft of the script, and you're like, yeah, but I have to have a conversation with every member of the team before I could even get close to that, right?
Yeah.
So
anyway, I should shout out my current clients at pushing vertices in a peculiar path for giving me all the time I need to just try to architect things. Right. I just trust special. That the words will just like come out like a fire hose once the structure is right. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, once you know the structure and you know the characters and you know the world, then sometimes writing can be very fast, right? Because you know where you're going and you know what you're doing. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That makes total
sense. And so much of it, every game is different, and it means that the writing pipeline, the narrative pipeline, can look completely different from one project to the next. So you also usually have to build a pipeline around how your story works.
Totally.
Around all the tools that are being used. I did a project where we did pre-production in Unity, and then we did production in Unreal.
So you have to redo everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Brilliant.
It's one of those things that just makes you go, I'm sorry, I just write the words. I'm just going to write the words.
My job now is lying down in ditches and looking at the sky. Peace out. I'm done. Yeah.
That's lovely. On this note of peacing out and being done at the right moments, right? Like when we want to be. I think we can perhaps end over there, even though clearly, Jill, we could be going on for quite a while. We have a lot in common, I think. Thank you. Thank you very, very much for coming on today to talk with us,
Jill. It's really nice to chat.
I think this will be really fun for the audience. Next week, we will move on to another episode. We will again rifle through the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope and find another article and speak to that contributor. So until then, thank you very, very much. I am Sagar.
And I'm John. Thank you for listening.